This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The late rock critic Lester Bangs is the subject of the new biography, Let It Blurt, that also tells the early history of rock criticism. My guest is the author, Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic for the Chicago Sun-Times. He describes Bangs as having reveled in the excesses of rock and roll, matching its passion in prose that erupted from the pages of Rolling Stone, Cream, and The Village Voice. In the process, he became a peer of the artists he celebrated, brash visionaries and dedicated individualists, such as Iggy Pop, Patti Smith, Richard Hell, and Lou Reed. Although Bangs was known for his excesses, DeRogatis says that this is not just the story of a guy who drank Romalar cough syrup by the gallon, insulted rock stars, then died. Without the poetry of his writing and his singular lust for life, the story would not have been worth telling. Bangs started publishing in the late 60s. He died in 1982 at the age of 33 of what is believed to have been a drug overdose. I asked DeRogatis to sum up Bangs' importance.
He was sort of the Jack Kerouac and the Charles Bukowski and the Hunter S. Thompson of rock criticism all rolled into one, a character who in many regards was larger than any of the people he wrote about, or at least as large, as much of a rock star as many of the rock stars he wrote about.
Can you read a paragraph from one of Lester Bangs' pieces that will help show why you think he was so special?
Absolutely. This is from the piece Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor Dung, which gives his anthology its name, 1987 anthology that Grill Marcus edited. Perhaps the truest autobiography I could ever write, and I know this holds as well for many other people, would take place largely at record counters, jukeboxes, pushing forward in the driver's seat while AM walloped you on, alone under headphones with vast scenic bridges and angelic choirs in the brain through insomniac post-midnights, or just to sit at leisure, stoned or not, in the vast benign lap of America, slapping on sides and feeling good.
And what do you like about
that? That's Lester on being a fan, on loving music, on being driven to preach about the music he loved.
Yeah, he once described shopping for records as being a major form of self-expression for him when he was young.
Yeah, and in another passage, described it as therapy, as something that saved his sanity. You know, he grew up in this what he called this ice cream and television suburban world of El Cajon, California, a suburb of San Diego, and he grew up a Jehovah's Witness. His mom was a fanatic religious person. There are pictures of him marching in front of San Diego Kingdom Hall with a sign that says, "What is your destiny?" And, you know, he had to go door to door and proselytize, and music was forbidden in the home, and it's never still to this day not a big part of Jehovah's Witnesses services. So when he broke out via the manic jazz of Mingus and Coltrane and beat poetry, he went in a big way. And then rock and roll was even more of a salvation. It was his way out of this entire upbringing.
You met Lester Bangs when you were a senior in high school. You were given the assignment of interviewing a hero. So you chose Bangs. You went to his apartment in Manhattan and did an interview with him. And in fact, you've brought some excerpts of that interview with you now. What were you expecting him to be like?
I think I had the cliched notion that a lot of his readers had, that he was this manic guy bouncing off the walls, some unholy combination of Hunter Thompson and Charles Bukowski and every rock star I'd ever seen, you know, Johnny Rotten and Jack Kerouac at the same time. And, you know, he wasn't like that at all. He was like my buddy. He was very solicitous of my opinions. He wanted to know what I was thinking, what I was reading, you know, what I was excited about. And I was that kind of blew me away. I wasn't prepared for that. You know, I was like, I'm a 17-year-old putz from New Jersey. What do you mean? You're Lester Bangs. But he was like that with everyone. He was very, very he always sought to communicate and find out what was getting people excited. And I think to him, rock and roll criticism was at its best when it was a discourse between people who were passionate about the subject, as passionate as he was.
You were talking to him a bit in your interview about his bad boy image and his image of, like, insulting people all the time, and this was his response.
You know, I mean, there was a time in my life when you would have come up here today and I would have got all drunk and everything and really, you know, just you might have preferred it that way and been really exhibitionistic, you know, and all that. But if I act like that, I ain't going to, I mean, I might live a long time, but I won't live very long as a good writer, you know. It's just... that's just the way it goes, the way it works. You know, like, you know, Charles Bukowski. Well, I mean, he's reached a point now. He's this poet out in L.A., you know? And he gets his picture taken all the time wearing a T-shirt with his face on it that says Bukowski on it, and he writes his poem. He wrote a poem behind his latest book that says, I can't write, you know? That's what he's used to, is writing a poem about how he can't write. You know?
That was Lester Bangs, recorded in a 1982 interview with my guest, Jim DeRogatis. And now DeRogatis has written a new biography of the late Lester Bangs. Jim, it's really ironic that Bangs was talking about how, you know, he thought he'd live longer if he by not being that combative personality in real life. He actually died just a couple of weeks after this interview that he recorded with you. What did he die of?
It was 2 weeks later when the news broke of his death, and I think for a very long time it's lingered out there, and nobody in the rock world was really certain. It's sort of obfuscated in the introduction to Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor Dung, the anthology of his work that was edited by Greil Marcus. I did the reporting years later, and the autopsy report reveals Darvon in his bloodstream, which was an analgesic painkiller. And that was known for its propensity for overdose. It was a dangerous drug, and it's no longer prescribed. And Valium as well. You know, all of his life he'd been an addict to various pills. Romalar, cough medicine, was a favorite. Dextromethorphan, the key ingredient in Romalar, which is no longer manufactured, is still in every cough medicine on the shelves today. It's the key ingredient that makes you stop coughing. And kids would abuse this through the 70s and into the early 80s. If you drink it in enough quantity, you trip like a wildebeest, as much as PCP. It's got psychedelic propensity. And now they put a chemical in cough medicine that's designed only to make you vomit if you drink enough of it to trip. But of all the things, at a time when cocaine and, you know, heroin and all the drugs that rock stars typically abuse were flowing, you know, rampantly, Lester was addicted to, you know, cough medicine and you know, cheap pills and alcohol.
Let's talk a little bit more about Lester Bangs as a critic. How did his taste in music compare to what we think of as like the rock and roll canon?
I think Lester was very much a proto Gen Xer. He was much of his career was in firm opposition to the baby boom critics. He was a baby boomer himself, but the baby boom pantheon that was being erected. You know, he did not hold that the Jefferson Airplane and all the San Francisco bands of 1967 were the high point of psychedelic rock or of rock and roll in the 60s. He preferred, you know, the grungy, what he called the Zit Farmers from San Jose, the Count Five, who recorded Psychotic Reactions and Carburetor Dung. And he lauded the Troggs, you know, the garage band from England, in the 30,000 word epic where he fantasized getting on a bus and driving to James Taylor and killing James Taylor in a brutal, violent assault, because he hated that sort of singer-songwriter music and celebrated this loud and aggressive proto-punk rock. He championed heavy metal and loved, called Black Sabbath the John Miltons of rock and roll. I can't emphasize enough that he had these great philosophical insights and intellectual, heavy intellectual ideas. Even when it was this, you know, rapid spew of colorful prose, there was real substantive ideas in there about the music he loved.
Now, although he loved music so passionately and felt so strongly about the musicians whose music he loved, he often got into these very combative relationships with musicians. And I think started to think of a lot of rock stars as being incredibly spoiled and obnoxious. You actually asked him, I think, about his interviewing style, about the combative style. Would you introduce this excerpt of the interview for us?
Exactly that. I mean, he was famous for his combative interviews with Lou Reed and for other rock stars, where he just refused to admit that they were the geniuses they were trying to portray themselves as, and would try to get at the real human being behind this image. And I asked him just that. How did you develop your interview style?
Well, basically, I just tried to start out to lead with the most insulting question I could possibly think of, you know, because it seemed to me that the whole thing of, like, interviewing, as far as, you know, rock stars and that, was just such a suck-up job, you know? I mean, it was, like, grovelingly, you know, just groveling obeisance to people that weren't that special, really, you know? It's just a guy. It's just another person. Right. So what?
That was Lester Bangs, recorded in a 1982 interview with my guest Jim DeRogatis, the author of a new biography of Bangs. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is rock critic Jim DeRogatis, author of Let It Blurt, a biography of the late rock critic Lester Bangs. Do you know what led Lester Bangs to want to start writing about rock?
I asked him that. I asked him exactly that, and this is what he said.
When I look back on it, it was obvious that I was going to end up doing this because of, you know, the two big obsessions are always music and writing, you know. It's like, you know, yeah, I mean, it's an outgrowth of being a fanatical record collector or, you know, a fanatical listener. And, you know, fanatical opinions that you want to inflict on people.
I think that soundbite gets to how extreme he felt about things and how deeply things registered on Lester Bangs. How did he start to write for Rolling Stone magazine?
In 1967, 68, Rolling Stone was desperate for anybody who would send anything in over the transom. And I talked to almost all the early editors at the magazine, and Lester was sending this stuff in, these long screeds, saying, "Look, you jerks, this is better than anything you're publishing, and you better run this or give me a reason why." And they were ignoring him because he was a shoe salesman who was tripping on Romolar, living in El Cajon, and they were, of course, in San Francisco, the center of the cultural universe in the Summer of Love. Finally, they ran a cover story on the MC5, and it was this fawning, glowing profile about how not only was the MC5 in Detroit a great rock and roll band, but they were going to be the leaders of the new revolution. And the White Panther Party, their manager, John Sinclair, was the leader of the White Panther Party. They were going to result in rioting in the streets and the New World Order and so on and so forth. And Lester rushed out and bought the album and thought that it was the biggest hype he had ever been sold. So he wrote this venomous response, record review in response, and it was so good that Rolling Stone finally published it. And he would, from that point on, he was sending four or five reviews a week, one or two of which might get published. And he was a big presence in Rolling Stone through its early golden days. When Grill Marcus became its first record review editor, he thought Lester was extraordinary, published him regularly. Those golden days only lasted, mind you, about a year. And Lester never really found his home at Rolling Stone. That was not where he did his best work. That would come later when he moved to Detroit and Cream Magazine. And when he got there, he met the members of the MC5, became best friends with them, and reversed his opinion. He came to think that the MC5 were a great band, and it was a shame that this political agenda had been superimposed on them. He did that a lot. A lot of times with Patti Smith or with Rolling Stone's Exile on Main Street, he would reverse his opinion, which I actually think is a sign of intellectual security, that he was strong enough in his own opinions that he could say, I've changed, I've grown, my opinion has been developed, and I've gained new insights. I don't think enough critics do that today.
Lester Bangs was banned from Rolling Stone in 1973. What kind of trouble did he run into at the magazine?
He'd gotten in trouble several times. He had panned Buddy Miles, who was, you know, this soul schlocky drummer, and Miles stormed into the offices of Rolling Stone at one point looking for Jan Wenner and was going to throw him out the window, and Wenner ran down the fire escape while the secretaries called the police, and Miles roughed up another editor. That was one strike against Lester. Another was that he panned Canned Heat in a very funny and sarcastic review, saying, you know, why do we love this endless boogie, let us count the ways. And Wenner apparently was close to the manager of Canned Heat and blew a gasket and said, you know, this guy is just not respectful enough to musicians.
Lester Bangs wrote a lot for Cream magazine. What was Cream's importance in the development of rock criticism?
Cream was an exceedingly irreverent publication. That I compare it to what was happening in new journalism. They were breaking the rules of criticism in journalism. Not that there were any rules. I mean, the whole form was developing, and it was this playground that just let the writers and the artists run free. And there were some great writing people like Nick Toshes and Richard Meltzer and Dave Marsh and Lester Bangs. They were kind of making up the rules as they went along, writing these long, passionate screeds that sometimes were directly about the music and sometimes had nothing to do with the music at all, but were trying to show that the writing itself could be rock and roll, and that you know, that they could create art that in some cases was better art than the music they were allegedly supposed to be covering. Meltzer prided himself on reviewing some albums by never opening the shrink wrap and just writing about the cover. which on one level shows a certain disrespect to the album, but on another, there was a deeper, more fundamental respect to the reader. They were having fun with the words. They were trying to create something that was very exciting, and they never underestimated the smarts of their readers, which is in stark contrast to a sort of criticism that exists today where everything's a 100-word record review and two thumbs up and these smiley, happy blurbs.
The people who worked for Cream lived together and worked together in a small farmhouse, and from your book it sounds like that was a pretty claustrophobic experience without any privacy.
It really was like a commune. They made $30 a month for spending on incidentals, and the publisher, Barry Kramer, stocked the refrigerator with bratwurst and beer, and they lived and worked in the same space. And it was even less privacy than they knew. I did a Freedom of Information Act request, figuring that the FBI was probably aware of these crazy hippie publishers because they were monitoring, of course, the White Panthers very, very closely from the 68 riots and before. And the feds were literally camped out in the woods like they did with the Unabomber, and occasionally spying on these people doing this magazine through binoculars and listening to Black Sabbath blaring from the woods, which is pretty funny. It's hard to imagine anybody like camping out and worrying about the reviewers at Entertainment Weekly today.
What would you say Lester Bangs' legacy is now in rock criticism?
That's a tough one, Terry. I think that a lot of people imitate the first person style and the gush of prose. Not even a lot of people. Some people imitate that. I think very few people go for the real legacy, which was that fundamental respect of the reader, that willingness to challenge the reader and to try to share deep philosophical insights and serious intellectual ideas with the reader, and not just this shilling of product. Here's a hip new album, go buy it, and next week there's another one. I think that that's what's been lost in rock criticism today, that there are very few people writing with that honesty or that commitment, and certainly not that that insight.
You're a rock critic yourself, and I'm wondering if you think that rock critics now are faced with a lot of pressures to be positive about the records they review, particularly when those records are on labels represented by heavy advertisers.
Oh, absolutely. I think that the thing to remember that in Bang's day, in Richard Meltzer and Nick Tosh's, when these guys were writing in the mid-70s, that there was no career as a rock critic. These guys were making $15 for these incredible, poetic, 15,000-word record reviews. And it was something you did because you believed in it passionately. And now it is possible to have a career as a rock critic and do very well in the same way that a lot of celebrity-oriented profilers write these obsequious, fawning profiles of Hollywood stars. That's the sort of journalism that's infected the rock world. And the people who are writing, because they feel compelled to do so in the same way that Bangs did, are pretty much marginalized. They're on the web, they're doing fanzines, or, if they're lucky, they're able to write for newspapers or editors that give them the freedom to do that. But I think that they're the exception rather than the rule.
You end your biography of Lester Bangs with one of his pieces, a very funny and perceptive piece called How to Be a Rock Critic. Let me ask you to end our interview with a short reading from this piece.
Absolutely. I wanted people to go out on a laugh and not be depressed, because I don't think Bangs' story is a depressing one. Lately, I've noticed a new wrinkle on the American landscape. It seems as if there's a whole generation of kids, each one younger than the last, all of whom live, breathe, and dream of but one desire. I want to be a rock critic when I grow up. If that sounds condescending, let it be known that I was once just like them. The only difference was that when I held such aspirations, the field was relatively uncluttered. It was practically nothing to barge right in and commence the slaughter. Whereas now, of course, it's so glutted that the last thing anybody should ever consider doing is entering this racket. In the first place, it doesn't pay much and doesn't lead anywhere in particular. So no matter how successful you are at it, you'll eventually have to decide what you're going to do with your life anyway. In the second place, it's basically just a racket in the first place, and not a particularly glorious one at that.
And he goes on to say, with language I can't really use, that it almost certainly won't get you any sex.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I think he was the exception. He was a rock critic who had groupies, probably the last one.
Jim DeRogatis, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your biography of Lester Bangs.
It was my pleasure, Terry.
Jim DeRogatis' biography of rock critic Lester Bangs is called Let It Blurt. DeRogatis is pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz on a new production of Macbeth, starring Kelsey Grammer. This is Fresh Air.